Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We need to be able to talk to about public banking in a way that's beyond just saving money and refinancing existing debt. It's to be able to utilize public banking to build a just future that incorporates immigrant justice, environmental justice, housing justice. That needs to be brought into the framework of public banking. Is like, how do we utilize our financial system to really evolve our society into a just future?
That's Trinity Tran, one of our guests today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, taking a bigger picture look at what public banking initiatives around the country represent for the society at large. It's not just money, but how public money in particular is deployed as a driver of key societal results. Hello, and welcome once again. I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus and Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen Brown's co-host. Today, we're going to spend a little time with the energetic and talented young folks who pulled off a remarkable result in Los Angeles's recent voter referendum, which asked for approval from voters to change the city's charter language to allow possible creation of a public bank. Trinity Tran was a principal driver of this effort, and she joins us today with one of her core colleagues on the Public Bank LA team, Ben Houck. The LA effort precedes a related and exciting new development emerging from the not-yet-installed congressional representatives, a Green New Deal. This idea replicates the bold initiatives of FDR following the Great Depression, in which he created public dollars to make public investments and help stabilize the economy while righting numerous social and economic injustices. Those themes remain central concerns in the public banking movement and are being championed by a youthful contingent of new congressional representatives focused on the impacts of climate change and fossil fuel on our common health and future. The proposed Green New Deal is putting public banking squarely in the center of the discussion as the means for getting past the impasse of austerity and debt. We'll dig into that policy development with Ellen in more detail on our next program. Later on in this program, we'll reprise an interview with Professor George Lakey, who was on the show discussing Viking economics, how the Scandinavians got it right and we can too. That discussion builds on the LA experience by describing what happens when the people have had enough, get their government to act, and actually make the social and economic changes they want. So let's get into that discussion with our colleagues from Los Angeles. While the recent referendum initiative was lost in the final vote count, it was a huge success as an indicator of public support. Despite having only a handful of weeks and virtually no money, the Public Bank LA Citizen Group of unpaid volunteers won 43% of the vote in the nation's second largest city, over 420,000 supporters, and have now set the stage for their city, and in fact the entire state of California, to take the next logical and necessary steps to enable public banks. Our guests are two of Public Bank LA's core leadership, Trinity Tran and Ben Houck. I asked Trinity how this remarkable campaign got started.
I founded Revolution LA in 2014, and it was focused on really creating an organic space for a new generation of activists to get involved in the community here in Los Angeles. And out of that came the Divest LA campaign and subsequently the Public Bank LA campaign. Everyone in our group and Public Bank LA is, we are all volunteers. This is an entirely volunteer-run organization, so we do have full-time jobs that we're balancing on top of our organizing work, which makes this so much more incredible of a campaign. Because we led a really mighty fight with very little resources, with very little time. you know, juggling conference calls and work emails in between a citywide ballot measure campaign. So it was an incredible operation, and we're quite proud of the outcome.
I take it neither of you are bankers, but how did you get it? Why did you get into this?
Yeah, not a banker, but I do have a more corporate background on the business side. And in my nights and weekends spare time, about 5 years back, I really started to get into environmental activism. And that really grew over the years and really culminated in a trip to Standing Rock in Thanksgiving 2 years back.
Right.
And upon seeing firsthand what the fossil fuel industry was doing, I wanted to come back home and bring solutions with me. So as soon as I returned, I was introduced to Trinity and Revolution LA, and that was really when we came together and helped create that Divest LA campaign, really looking to go after the fossil fuel industry through the money supply, the flow of capital. And, of course, that was a successful movement in Los Angeles with Divest LA going after Wells Fargo Bank and getting the city to commit to eventually cease doing business with Wells Fargo Bank.
And that was really the foundation for the public bank campaign was the money. It was what the banks were doing with your money.
Yep. Absolutely. It was accountability. And, you know, LA City Council had never really looked at our finances. I mean, no city really did prior to the divestment movements that first started in Seattle with Seattle and the indigenous communities there working with Councilmember Kashama Sawant to push Seattle City Council to divest $3 billion from Wells Fargo. That was what kind of started a chain effect among other cities like Santa Monica, City of Santa Monica here in California, which then divested $1 billion from Wells Fargo, which then inspired us to lead the movement here to really create accountability for our tax dollars. At the end of the day, we didn't want our city funds, our tax dollars, going to big banks like Wells Fargo that used that money to finance harm against communities of color, that used our money to finance destructive pipelines that led to indigenous oppression. So through our conversations with City Hall, through our citizens' lobbying efforts at City Hall, we really inspired the council members to figure out how to decentralize our funds from these too big to fail destructive big banks.
So in that stage of the process, then, you started to get some traction by speaking to the councilmen individually and appealing to their ethical grounding?
Yes, we created a citizens lobbying team where we would build alliances. We sat down and had meetings with various council members and the legislative directors and built alliances with the Office of Finance and City Council at City Hall. Through those relationships, we were able to have a dialogue. So it wasn't just screaming from a protest through a bullhorn for a city council to divest. It was us figuring out how to maneuver through the technical processes that would enable City Council to do something like remove their finances, their commercial holdings from Wells Fargo. So that took a lot of research on our part to spend weekends, you know, trying to read banking contracts when none of us had any financial history or financial background, and trying to figure out, you know, how we could sit down and talk to them. And while we were building alliances in City Council, we also brought on quite a few social justice groups like ACE and Committee for Better Banks and AIM and SoCal 350, who really came in and delivered some really moving testimony about how big banks were affecting communities of color and the illegal foreclosures that had happened to senior citizens who had been victimized by Wells Fargo Bank, and bank workers, whistleblowers who had been fired by these big banks. So we really leveraged an inside-outside game to really inspire City Council to move towards something as bold and revolutionary as public banking.
And you also got City Council to adopt a new parameters for investing, an ethical standards for city investing.
Yes, a 30-point social responsibility scoring, which made it for most. It is currently, I believe, the most progressive in the country because, in comparison, the city of Seattle scores their social responsibility at 20 points, and San Francisco at 5 points. So, with a 30-point social responsibility scoring, which looks at the bank's enforcement, federal enforcement actions, their community lending practices, that was definitely our movement that helped secure that 30-point social responsible guideline. And so through our advocacy, it really opened the door for city council to look at a more permanent solution to divestment, because at the end of the day, we knew that divesting from Wells Fargo would lead the city to then turn to the other five banks that typically apply for the request for proposal banking contract, which is Bank of America, Chase, your usual suspects. So we knew it wasn't really divesting if they were just going to move their funds from one big bank to another big bank, and that public banking would be a more permanent solution.
And so at the moment, where does LA put its money?
So here's the interesting thing, because during the last 2 months, we had one of the organizations that endorsed us, Friends of the Earth, was writing an article about the city's divestment from Wells Fargo, and they were asking about where the money was going to. And so I actually circled back to the Office of Finance to try to figure out what the timeline was, because as originally planned, they would have had already awarded a new contract to another bank. So what happened was, because of how strenuous the process was to break up over through the city council's vote, over 800 Wells Fargo contracts have been broken up. And so they're still in the process of trying to figure out where to move the money. So as of right now, unfortunately, they extended the contract for another year with, I believe, 2 6-month options to renew. So they said Wells Fargo wasn't one of the banks that submitted their contract because they were disqualified from our efforts. They were disqualified because of their substandard community reinvestment act rating. But we will be following up with that to see where it's going next. But I mean, as I mentioned, it would be one of the five big banks that typically have applied for the RFP in the past.
So you started out as the name in Revolution LA. You know, the revolutionary tone here is really part and parcel of what your campaign is about and what your work is about. Tell us a little bit more. What's your vision or your sense of how banking fits into this revolutionary notion that you have? What do you think, Ben?
It's interesting to really see. I mean, for myself coming at this, 2 years ago, I didn't know what public banking was. And even when we started discussing the possibility of a public bank as a solution after divesting from Wells Fargo, I didn't quite get it for a little. You know, it took me a couple of months to really understand the power of banking and how interconnected banking is with all of the problems in our society and all of the potential solutions in our society. So when I first started looking at this as, okay, yeah, that could give us a great option of moving our money out of Wells Fargo or out of these predatory banks that are financing, you know, pipelines and fossil fuel extraction and private prisons and immigrant detention centers, moving our money out of those banks is powerful all by itself. But even more powerful is being able to leverage the power that banks have to lend and to provide financing for the things that we want. You know, at the end of the day, it's not enough for us to say no to things. You know, no can be powerful and stopping things can be powerful, but the no is not enough. Like Naomi Klein wrote in her book, no is not enough. We need to be building the answers and the solutions for the world we want tomorrow. And we really saw public banking as a true cornerstone foundational solution to so many problems, whether it's affordable housing, building out the clean, renewable energy infrastructure we need to combat climate change, whether it's rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, schools, whatever that is, this can truly be a powerful, foundational solution to all of those issues. So when we saw that, we knew that this is something that we not only had to start fighting for, but to put at the center of our fight for this idea of what Revolution LA stands for.
So part of your campaign, which was enormously exciting and successful, even though the numbers didn't come out in your favor, you got 400,000 people to say yes. I think we need, we want to make this change in our city charter to enable a public bank, and you got over 100 civic groups to support the Yes on B referendum vote. What was your pitch, if you will, for these other interest groups to get them to buy in, and what was their response?
We ended up with actually 150 political organizations and community groups that signed on to endorse Measure B. Even before the measure was on the ballot, we were attending Democratic clubs to talk about public banking. Because, Walt, it's been a pretty public banking, even though it's been around for a while, it's been relatively obscure for most voters. So there was an educational process that started a bit before the ballot came on, the measure was on the ballot. And the pitch was very, very simple. The city of Los Angeles currently spends billions of dollars that go in Wall Street banks. Wall Street banks uses this money to finance harm against our community. It's time for us to create a new solution for our banking to be able to utilize our tax dollars to fund and finance the things we need, like affordable housing and green energy infrastructure. And, public banking at the end of the day is intuitive. Once you start explaining it, people naturally understand that Wall Street is bad. That consciousness, was solidified after the Occupy movement, that really created that 99% versus 1% narrative. And so, people have always wanted a solution to Wall Street, but they never knew what that was. Mm. And so what public banking does is that it offers that solution. This isn't just saying screw the banks. This is saying, hey, right, let's create a new socially and environmentally responsible solution.
Yeah, when we were talking to, for example, unions, we had several major unions endorse, both local and national. The argument there, and it can vary a little bit depending on the union, but if you look at, 50% or more of the cost of infrastructure, for example, in LA or in California, is going to interest and fees. If we're able to leverage public banking, we can almost double the power of our spending. The money, the taxpayer dollars, can do more with infrastructure. That's more great jobs. That's building healthier, more resilient, robust communities. It's regenerating and rebuilding. And that message truly resonates with the workers and with the unions.
The common sense appeal, the magnetism, the logic of the public banking option, what about the pushback? What kind of pushback did you get in from what corners?
We saw a significant pushback from, of course, the banking industry. We had the Western Bankers Association. We had, the American
California Association. Bankers Association.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we had basically all of the big bank associations come out against us. And we had a couple very outspoken, anti-government voices also here in L.A., who are speaking against us. And it came down to a lot of these common arguments you're going to hear, which is, you can't trust the politicians. This is going to turn into a pet project for, City Hall. You're going to have city council members sneaking money to their, big donors. It was a lot of fear-mongering over the process. It was a lot of fear-mongering over what would be done with the money. And there was a lot of misinformation that was spread by the big banks,
LA Times,
and by their spokespeople, and LA Times.
The LA Times editorial piece was really what was our greatest opposition was that was that editorial piece, because it was timed in a way that where it came out right before absentee ballots hit. So before we were able to fundraise to be able to reach voters and educate them on public banking, or even to inform voters about the Measure V vote, the LA Times editorial board piece came out, and that was highly destructive because it was a lot of disinformation and fear-mongering. They had sat down for an hour with Council President Wessman, our legislative director, Dave Jetty, as well as Ellen Brown, and they proceeded to disregard everything that was said within that hour sit-down. And instead created this piece that that caused a lot of uncertainty and fear and, you know, among people who had never heard about public banking, you know, instead of the LA Times focusing on the Bank of North Dakota, for instance, as a model to emulate, as a successful model to emulate, they instead kind of, you know, said one line that just disregarded it as a century-old bank that was created for farmers. You know, so it was intentionally written in a way that would, you know, deter a lot of voters from support. And at the end of the day, when the votes came out, it was quite evident that all of the early voters, most of the early voters, were the no votes.
So you got very close, remarkably close, I mean, given the lack of funds and time, but still lost the referendum business. Where does it sit now? How is the city council looking at this? Is it still on their screen? What are next steps with them? Will you take next steps?
Well, incredibly, right after November 6th, a few days after November 6th, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out with her Green New Deal resolution aimed at really creating large-scale action for climate change. And that amazingly incorporated public bank as public banking as a way to finance green energy infrastructure and green jobs and our transition to renewable sources, to 100% power generation from renewable sources. So that's now put public banking on a greater national radar, because now you have major influencers, aside from AOC, like Naomi Klein and Congress people, who are now pushing for a Green New Deal committee that includes public banking as a solution to finance this transition. So we are very excited about the future of public banking. We've now pivoted to our efforts at the state level through our California Public Banking Alliance. And this alliance is something that we formed back in May. And it includes eight cities, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland, and a few other cities in California, that's working to create one uniform framework for a network of municipal and regional banks. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the questions that voters may have had as far as what is this bank going to look like, what's the governance structure, how is it going to be insured, those questions will be answered through this California Public Banking Alliance CPBA bill that we're working on to hopefully get introduced in the first of the year. So as we're working on getting legislators together to sponsor and author this bill, we're also meeting next week as is our group here in Los Angeles to continue our efforts here in Los Angeles to educate voters, to continue our efforts on securing community union endorsements. And so we're very excited about the future of public banking. When this ballot started, no one knew about public banking, and now 400,000 Angelenos support the idea.
Ben, do you feel like inside of your corporate experience, is this a topic that is welcomed or understood, or is this still an outlier in people's reckoning about what's going on?
I believe it's still an outlier. We did an incredible job as a small group of volunteer part-time activists. Putting together a ballot measure committee, you know, getting 420,000 votes and counting, and really exposing hundreds of thousands of Los Angeles voters to the idea of public banking for the very first time. With that said, we still have a lot of work to do, and we have a lot of education to do on the public about what public banking is, what it is not, and what it can do for the people. And, you know, when we started the California Public Banking Alliance, and we had our first strategy meeting up in San Francisco, our intent all along was to start with the state legislation, which would build that framework and answer a lot of those questions of how will it be structured and how will it work and what will governance look like and so forth. That was our plan all along. When the Measure B was sprung on us by City Council President Herb Wesson, which we were very excited about, we weren't quite ready for it. Mm-hmm. In 4 months, we did an amazing job, and just absolutely incredible job on reaching as many people as we did and getting those yes votes. But being honest, we had no organization to do that type of work. We had zero money, and we were dealing with all volunteers. So we weren't quite ready for that stage of the process. So now we're going back to the original strategy, which is get the state legislation passed first. Then once the framework is in place, then we come back to LA, we come back to the city council, we come back and get this back on the ballot and get it passed.
You'd mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC as we call her now, talking about creating a Green New Deal. And I find that very inspiring and exactly as you suggested, Trinity, a step into the national spotlight. What do you think should be the next steps for those of us who are moving public banking around the country? What should the message be that will bring people around this opportunity?
I think it's so important to inspire the masses, similar to what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is doing by now getting the Democratic Party to make climate change a priority. You know, we need to be able to get influencers and legislators inspired to really take public banking and, as Ben mentioned earlier, to make it a cornerstone issue, progressive issue of the progressive platform. So we need to be able to talk about public banking in a way that's perhaps beyond just saving money and refinancing existing debt, is to be able to utilize public banking to build a just future, to create a future that is socially just, that incorporates immigrant justice, environmental justice, housing justice. That needs to be brought into the framework of public banking. Is like, how do we utilize our financial system to really evolve our society into a just future?
And Ben, for you, how does this fit into the political and social landscape of America these days?
Well, when you look at where the country seems to be headed, you look at the quote-unquote blue wave that moved across the country, when you see a new, diverse, younger group of representatives being elected, they're not being elected because people want more of the same. This new group of freshmen representatives and all of the people elected from the state level to the national level were elected because the people want something different. They want to build something different. What we're doing right now is not working. Whether you're looking at it from a climate change perspective or income inequality, if you're looking at it from the housing problem we have and the homelessness issue, what we're doing right now is not working. And we can't just say that we don't want those things anymore. We have to be able to build a vision of what we want and a vision of what the world will be. And that's going to require some very bold ideas. And public banking, though it's tried and true in different parts of the world and in North Dakota, it still is a bold idea of taking that power that's been held and monopolized by Wall Street for so long and putting it into the hands of the people, putting it into the hands of our cities and our states. That's what we need to do. We need to show people that vision of what public banking can do for them and really show that, yes, this is, it's thrown around a lot as an intersectionality issue. This truly is. Public banking truly can be a cornerstone of the progressive platform. And we truly believe that that's how it has to be messaged. Yes, we can talk about it'll save money. Yes, we can talk about some of the wonky financial aspects of public banking. And they're all important. But at the end of the day, we need to inspire people. We need to relate to people, and we need to be talking about solutions to the problems that the people are experiencing.
Thank you both for your boldness, your courage, and your hard work, and not just the two of you, but all of your team in Los Angeles, be assured that you have inspired the whole nation of people who are working toward this economic justice and fairness.
And if I can end it with, if anyone here is listening and they're in Los Angeles and they're ready to fight for round two, lend your skills, join us, email us at collective@revolutionla.org.
Thank you so much, Trinity and Ben Houck. Thank you so much, guys.
Now let's take some encouragement about the larger struggle for economic fairness and democratic control as we chat with George Lakey, noted author, Swarthmore professor, Quaker peace activist, and a founder of the Movement for a New Society, whose book entitled Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and We Can Too. As we move together toward the creation of new systemic responses and vehicles for recapturing some monetary control for the public interest, George Lakey lays out what has worked in the past and how the changes occurred that have made the Scandinavian countries a model for the world of economic balance and fairness.
What is the essence of the Viking economics model that you think teach us a lesson and is an opportunity for us?
It puts the common good first. That's the overriding consideration. So on the one hand, it hugely promotes individual freedom. In fact, Norwegians, for example, have more individual freedom than we do. And on the other hand, puts a framework around people's individual choices such that the common good is also promoted. And they don't see a contradiction between those two. They believe that individual freedom is more likely to be enhanced when economic policies are organized around the common good as well.
And economic changes and reforms have been instrumental in making the systemic changes, hasn't it?
Huge. Huge difference. A century ago, Denmark and Sweden and Norway and Iceland, especially Iceland, were full of poverty. In fact, you're probably aware, and your listeners are probably aware, that tons of Norwegians and Swedes fled their countries 100 years ago and even before because there was simply no economic opportunity over there for people who didn't already have some money or weren't the first sons of farmers, you know, who would inherit the land. And so they were simply countries that could not figure out, or at least their 1% could not figure out how to create shared prosperity. And so a lot of people from Scandinavia came to the U.S., came to Canada and other countries. And so what they're changed now to the point where they're, and have been for now for decades and decades, at the top of the international ratings with regard to economic indicators. That's an enormous change. That's a sea change. So it's not even a matter of tweaking their way there. They actually had to come to a point of confrontation with the economic elite, which historically, of course, had run the countries. And they had basically to say, well, look, you're not doing very well. Look at your track record. You're doing very poorly. So we're firing you as the economic leadership of the country, and we're taking over instead. And so the majority of people took over in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And to some degree in Iceland, although not as fully that way, and their big push then got to be very recently, 2008. But of course, they are also the newest country in terms of independence. So in some ways, Iceland lags a little bit behind, although compared with the U.S., they still have a really fine economic record.
So the economic elite in Scandinavia, I presume, were entrenched just as they are here in the U.S. now. How did the people manage to overcome the overwhelming, probably, power of the elite?
Well, one thing they did was develop the common vision of an alternative. And that was really important to inspire the sacrifice that was involved in making those changes, because there was, of course, pushback from the economic elite. Troops were called out in both Sweden and in Norway, and for that matter in Denmark at an earlier point. The troops were called out, repression, people were put in jail, people were killed, people were shot down while they were engaged nonviolently in campaigns for change. And so there was the pushback from the economic elite, and one of the things that inspired people to keep on going, keep on struggling in order to make their revolution was the fact that they had a vision of how different things could be. And that's extraordinary because, I mean, we have the luxury, in America can say, okay, so obviously things could be much, much better because we can just look at Scandinavia and see things could be much better. But 100 years ago, the Scandinavians couldn't say that. You know, they couldn't point to some place and say, whoa, this is the place where there's economic democracy. In fact, for them, it was a really visionary movement. They had to believe in the possibility that a democracy can create an economy that is democratic. And they believed. And so they did what I have written as a nonviolent revolution and pushed the 1%, pushed the economic elite out of power.
And how did that get propagated? How did they promulgate that vision? Through what sort of community resources?
Study groups were really important.
Study
groups are very important. It was routine for people to gather together in living rooms and churches and so on and talk about what do we really want. And there were economists, far-sighted economists, who were willing to work with the study group movement, with the adult education movement, and so they would put out these papers, you know, that would often be need to be translated by journalists into things that people could understand and work with and chew over and consider whether this is what they wanted. So that was part of it, but another big part was the actual skill building that was involved in creating cooperative institutions. So they really did believe in co-ops at a very early point. The earliest people on that were Sweden. It's a fun thing for me about studying all four countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Iceland, is that one country would often learn from another. So the Swedes were the earliest ones to build a really strong co-op movement. So there you had ordinary people, farmers, small family farmers, and workers, and, you know, just ordinary folks, learning the skills of managing for themselves. They'd always been managed by someone else, right? This was their chance to learn what is it like to have an economic enterprise that works for the benefit of the whole. And so that built confidence as well. So not only did they have their vision, but they had the confidence that grew from co-ops that worked better. And this is still the case, co-ops working better than free enterprises working.
Yeah, very interesting. 100 years ago, perhaps around the same time, early 20th century, the farmers in North Dakota were meeting in study groups, and they were talking about creating this cooperative stand of protecting their own interests. So it sounds like it's very much like a mirrored sort of an experience out on the plains of
absolutely.
America.
In fact, some of the people who became leaders in the Norwegian and I believe Sweden as well, but I'm more sure about the Norwegian movement, came to the U.S. to learn how to be more effective labor organizers or how to be more effective co-op people, because at that time, 100 years ago, the U.S. was, at least in some states, as you say, North Dakota, in some states, the U.S. was ahead of Scandinavia in terms of our own journey toward what I'm now calling Viking economics.
Yeah, interesting, because I know there's a fair amount of Northern Europe settlement in Northern America.
That's
in
right.
The northern part of our country, Minnesota,
right.
And Wisconsin, all of those states very reform-minded liturgically or theologically anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very interesting. So the status of the people who were living in Scandinavia at that time, were they being deprived? Did they have no opportunity to participate? How were they You know, I'm just wondering what kind of deprivation they were living in.
That's right. That's right. There was very little social mobility. If you were born into a working class family, that's how you would die. If you were born into farming and a farm laborer, perhaps moving from one place to another, if you were born to a logging family or a fisher family, then that's how you would die. There was very little social mobility, and there was more in comparison in the United States, so that's one reason why they, and in Canada, so that's one reason why they came across the Atlantic. They thought, well, there's some chance to move upward in life. And then that situation is reversed, so there's way more social mobility now in Scandinavia than there is in the United States. We're way more frozen and stuck in how people are born and then stay that way in their lives, and over there there's way more flexibility and mobility, which has to do with their enormous investment in education, quality education, free education, free higher education, for example. Go to university for free, go to colleges for free, go to all kinds of engineering school, and, you know, whatever you name, ballet school, whatever you name, it's free over there because they have a huge commitment to education as a way that people can sort themselves out. And they don't say it's awful to be an auto mechanic, or it's awful to be a farmer, or, you know, awful to, you know, to be a trolley car driver. It's not that they diss working class jobs. And in fact, people have a very livable life as working class people. There's no poverty there. They pretty much gave up poverty, the Scandinavian countries did, because they thought people should not live in poverty. There's no excuse for it. So 19th century. So 19th century. Why would people bother to have poverty anymore? And yep. And they went ahead and abolished poverty, which the United States could easily do as well, because we have a model for doing it and we have more resources than they do. But they went ahead and did that. And so it's not that they say, you know, the only worthwhile life is a middle-class life or professional life. It's that everyone should live in dignity, but if you happen to be born into a working-class family, but you are gifted at, say, writing and scholarship, or you're gifted at piano playing or something, then you should go ahead and go right to the limit of your talent and your drive to be able to do that. And our job as society is to help you to do that, because that will actually support the common good.
It's just remarkable to hear that story. I compare it to what I think are the citizen realities here in the U.S. about how locked in and absolutely overburdened with debt and the obligations of debt people are, such that that kind of a vision really sounds like blue sky, sort of an impossible dream from our cultural perspective, at least one that I think most people perceive. So that in the Scandinavian experience, it must have started with just a handful of folks. There's some sort of a, yeah.
That's right. Margaret Mead is right. It always starts with a small group.
Right.
And, of course, it did there as well. And that, to me, is very encouraging, because we do have plenty of small groups now in our society, and things are picking up. I was a youngster in the 60s. I learned a tremendous lot from the civil rights movement and the other movements that existed. I was participating in those. In fact, my first arrest was in a civil rights sit-in. And so those movements started with small groups, and once again, we've got small groups burgeoning, and it's very, very encouraging. Well, in Scandinavia, as you say, they also started with small groups. But things took hold, partly because there was so much suffering. People were hungry. People were starving. So just as in the United States, hunger is growing as well. So the conditions in the U.S. are amazingly like the conditions 100 years ago over there. In fact, they also had a pretend democracy, right? They had a parliament. They had free elections. And so their propaganda about themselves coming from the economic elite was, well, we have democracy, but somehow the decisions that directed society were always made for the benefit of the economic elite, and that's the same as here. So I find a lot of parallels between them before, you know, as they were gathering to get ready to make their big shove, and here, because I think that's also what we're gathering to do, and that so many Americans are now seeing through the pretense of our democracy and realizing it's not enough to vote. Voting is all right, but it doesn't have really much power to it, and if you really want power, then you have to organize social movements that use nonviolent direct action to coerce the economic elite to get out of the way and let us have what we want.
One of the really wonderful accomplishments that you've achieved with the group was about the confronting a big bank mm-hmm. over its investment and continued support for mountaintop removal, one of the most heinous environmental disasters that we've tolerated. Is the process of your success there an example of what we're talking about now?
Yes, indeed. We were building the skills as we went and building the self-confidence, just as those early nonviolent campaigns did for the Scandinavians. Because in the beginning, as you said, the small groups were hopeful in Scandinavia, but larger people would say, well, what can we do? We feel kind of powerless. And that's how a lot of people looked at mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia, too, when we started our group. In fact, 500 mountains had already been blown up in Appalachia, and cancer rates were doubled in the areas where those mountains were being blown up, and birth defect rates were high. And so we realized there were a lot of people who had lost their sense of agency, lost their sense of power. Right. And so our group was very intentional about not only targeting the bank, because the bank could be socially responsible if it were forced to be. So we had a clarity about the target, the bank, and we had a clarity about the demand we were making, which is to stop it, stop financing mountaintop removal. And at the time we started, PNC Bank was the number one financier of mountaintop removal coal mining. So it was just right. But also, at the same time, we knew that even though our group started in the living room, that's how small we were in the beginning, that by the end, we would be much larger. And indeed, we were able to have demonstrations on the same day in 13 states. And PNC looked at that and said, well, there's just no stopping these people. They're expanding, they're growing, they're expanding, they're growing. The only way we can stop this movement that is destroying our brand as a bank is to give in and to stop financing mountaintop removal coal mining. And so they finally did. 125 actions, though.
Wow.
So it's not overnight, and again, that's like in Scandinavia, because it wasn't overnight there either. It took a while to do that.
Yeah, what an amazing accomplishment, though, and I'm interested to see that it was a branding consideration that moved the bankers, claiming the social standing of the bank moved them. We have similar sort of undertakings with the public banking movement, as we call out the role that Wall Street, the extraction of Wall Street from our communities. Of course, we're not alone in that, but this partnering together with all of these other citizens groups, from Occupy through to the Sustainable Business Council and so many others, where there's terrific change underway in the U.S. right now. You have a term called prefigurative politics, mm-hmm. and it follows education, but it precedes confrontation. Do I have that right?
That's
would
right.
Would you just say a couple of words about what prefigurative
sure.
politics is and how it's...
The reason we use that term, and we don't use it all that frequently, of course, because it's a kind of an odd term, but what I like about it is that it prefigures the vision. So first comes the vision, and then we prefigure it, we figure it, we show it, we image it in the here and now in order that it has more tangibility. So, for example, if we want public banking, if we want Pennsylvania to follow North Dakota's example and have a state bank, we can gain some heart from knowing that credit unions outperform private banks. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, credit unions are a prefigurative institution, and members of boards of credit unions and the members themselves, like I'm a member of a credit union, and the people who work for credit unions, all can say, hey, we know that banking for the common good works because that's what we do, and our neighborhood benefits enormously from keeping the money here, investing it, you know, in my neighbor's kitchen rehab, investing it in the new car down the street. We know that it works for us, and that gives us a kind of confidence. And I really underline that word confidence because I find my fellow Americans a little bit with a limiting belief that we just aren't powerful. We can't be powerful. But actually, if we borrow our confidence from the fact that we've done so much already, then we can see that, yes, we have been confident, we have been powerful, and one of the ways we've been powerful is in doing that. There's talk, I think Elizabeth Warren may be one of the people who's talking about reinvigorating the old post office banks that used to exist in right. our postal system, and that was a very popular thing in Scandinavia as well. That was one of the forms of public banking. They had municipally owned banks, and they had state banks that still do. But they also they used the postal system because it was so convenient, post offices in so many neighborhoods, and people could deposit their savings there and build up their savings in that way. So sometimes we just need a reminder of how well we've done to realize, wait a minute, we don't have to be so intimidated by, you know, the Goldman Sachs's of the world. We could actually say, based on track record, public institutions are actually doing better than you are, and let's just move you out of the way and take that over.
Yeah, it's interesting because the Wall Street Journal did a report about the Bank of North Dakota and compared it to Goldman Sachs and to J.P. Morgan and so forth about a year ago, and indicated that the Bank of North Dakota outperforms them well over 2-1 in terms of the return on equity, which is like a measure of efficiency, profitability, this Wall Street should be envious of these little people on the prairie who are doing their own thing. Well, this is very, very powerful, George. I appreciate it because my sense is that people really do need to be encouraged to rediscover their power as citizens, and with the discovery that of how badly we're being taken advantage of, and with the clear options that are on the table relative to alternatives, like the collectives that you're talking about, I mean the cooperatives that you're talking about, it seems to me that there's a very big shift going back toward the local economy as opposed to trying to take a stand and make a play inside of a global economy, which is so out of touch with most people. Is it your sense, too, that structurally and systemically that this is kind of the way forward, the way around the obstacle of elite control?
Well, it's a wonderful trend. I see it, too. You see it more than I do because you've really focused on that in a particularly wonderful way. But I also see it as I travel around doing bookstore tours. And it's a very, very heartening thing. However, I do run into folks who set those two change modes in opposition to each other, as if prefigurative institutions, you know, like our efforts to do public banking and the credit unions and so on, the transition town movement, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. as if that is in contradiction to nonviolent direct action campaigns. And I think the Scandinavians had it right. They did both at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the big advantage of doing both at the same time, and that doesn't mean that each individual does both at the same time, because after all, we have to take responsibility for our own time budget. And it would be pretty impossible to start a co-op and also do a campaign at the same time. But that the movement support each other in doing both of those, because the one feeds the other. the confidence that we gain from the prefigurative institutions gives us more heart for confronting the existing capitalist institutions like PNC Bank and stopping them from doing nasty things. And the Scandinavian example, which is the clearest example of success in moving an economy hugely forward, it shows that prefigurative institutions can only go so far before the 1%, the economic elite, pushes back in their own interests. It's totally natural. It doesn't mean they're nasty. It just means that they're pushing back in their own interests. And so they will push back. And we have to have the skills and courage and solidarity to be able to push harder than they do. That's what we need. And it's an building alternative institutions doesn't necessarily give us that. We can be so focused on the bookkeeping or the sheer management of an enterprise, even a people's enterprise, that we forget the skills of nonviolent struggle. And nonviolent struggle is absolutely essential, because without it, we simply can't coerce the economic elite to move out of its leadership role of the whole economy. And so the alternatives that you and I love will always just play a little sister role in the economy. They can never direct the economy until those who do direct the economy are pushed out of the way. And the reality is that can be done. That can be done. And my book demonstrates that, both in the live examples in Scandinavia, and also shows in the last chapter how we can do that here in this country, partly because we have an amazing track record of partial achievement in that way. And what we can do is use what we've learned in our partial achievement and take it all the way.
And you say that that possibility exists even though the global financial cartel that really is into everything is so huge that you still maintain that the people can impact its control and its domination.
That's right. And that's one reason why I called it Viking economics, in order to remind ourselves how very small those Viking boats were. Nevertheless, crossed not only the North Sea to Britain, but even crossed the Atlantic, the mighty North Atlantic. And that's what those small countries did. Remember, Norway never lived in a time that wasn't globalized. Norway never lived in a time when it wasn't dependent on global market forces that were way bigger than the Norwegians were. They never had it their way, in the sense that the U.S. has had it our way. And they were up against enormous forces. So was Sweden, so was Denmark, and so was Iceland. Iceland, most of all, only 320,000 people in Iceland. Talk about being at the mercy of humongous forces. And the point is that their ability to transform their own societies, despite the fact that they always experienced globalization, means that we, with our huge economy, we're still the number one economy in the world. Yes, we can take on the global scale. We, again, need to be in touch with our powerfulness instead of making excuses for powerlessness, which is never the way to get something done.
That's beautiful. I thank you very much, George, for this conversation. And I the metaphor that I'm sticking in my mind is this beautiful, this idea of our own personal little boats, the ability to transcend and to discover entirely new possibilities is really at the heart of this movement. And you've expressed it so beautifully. Thank you so much for this conversation today, George.
Thanks for the opportunity.
That's George Lakey, author of Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right, and We Can Too. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.